Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. We do post articles that we cite in here, things related to our topics on these social media places. So, you know, yes, subscribe, hit that like button, all those things. So your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Utterback, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Longtime listeners may have missed us last week. We've decided to switch to a bi-weekly episode release rather than weekly. We wanted to follow our own advice and focus more on product quality than quantity. For today, our topic is how to live in alignment with your values and purpose. So before we begin, if you want to catch up, episode 10, we talked about what values and purpose were at a very high level. In episode 11, we talked about how to identify your values and purpose, and we introduced our model of purpose and meaning. In this podcast, we're going to break down some of the nuts and bolts about how to live that purpose. And so we're going to cover, we're going to start by talking about why it's even so hard to change some of our maybe bad habits. We're going to talk about goals, habits, and behaviors and how to bring your daily actions into alignment with your values and purpose. And then we're going to talk a little bit about discipline as a skill. What that once developed helps us to ensure successful execution of those goals, habits, and behaviors. And so if we think back a couple episodes, we talked about that Seneca quote, for the man who knows not which port he sails, no wind is favorable. So knowing the port is sort of that goal. If you think your purpose is I'm a sailor, your goal is the port, right? So if we say, like, I'm going to sail to the Bahamas, that's my goal. How do I get there is also those sort of, it's not just the Bahamas and I'm going to luckily get there. You have to swab the deck and scrape off the barnacles, and you have to constantly sort of check back in and reflect on the stars and the maps, and am I getting where I think I'm going? And so that the execution of a successful sailing to the Bahamas helps me live in alignment with my purpose as sailor. And so that sounds pretty simple, and it is, but it's often far from easy. And Phil, maybe you could tell us why.
Simple but not easy is always a good thing, right? Yeah. My daily life, I've noticed doing this research for these several podcasts has made me think more. I mean, I think I tend to focus more on values in my own daily life more than goals. But from what I'm also reading out there is that, that means that other people are setting my goals, maybe.
Right,
And that maybe I should be more intentional about them. So I'm trying to think about this. So why is it so hard to create habits and kind of work toward our goals? And I think this really is a difficult thing. I mean, one study shows that it's something like 88% of New Year's resolutions fail. And that when we have goals and intentions to meet them, other research shows, sometimes we have like about a 50% achievement rate in that. And so why is this hard? Why is this difficult? We're going to cover a number of things in this episode. Again, this is designed to be a little bit more applied. Part of it is that our brains are habit machines, and creating new habits and breaking old habits is hard. Because by definition, habits are things that run relatively automatically. They don't require much effort on our part, and they tend to be driven by things in the environment. And so we all feel this. For example, if you see your smartphone and without even thinking about it, you've picked it up, you've opened something on social media, and you're staring about it. There wasn't necessarily an intention to pick up your phone or check on something specifically. It's an automatic behavior, stimulus driven by the environment. And so this is why habits are difficult. And some of that gets essentially into the neurochemistry in that, we have reward centers in the brain. Habits are well-learned kind of neural pathways that run automatically. They're driven by the environment. And so we get these reward feelings often for doing some of them, like dopamine. And you and I recently read Dopamine Nation.
Yeah, Anna Lemke's book, we highly, highly recommend it. Lemke is a psychiatrist, is also the chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic at Stanford University. And she outlines dopamine as this hormone. Often we neuroscience early thought of it as sort of the reward hormone. I like to think of it more as the yes hormone. So you do a thing, particularly from an evolutionary perspective, you know, you had to go out and hunt. If you found honey, you were looking for calorie-dense foods. You found honey, dopamine pops. Yes, do that again. Go find the honey again. That's good. We like that. And so it essentially sort of helps us figure out what the system wants to do, which also points out a little about like who's actually running this thing.
Yeah.
But like it's sort of saying like yes do that do that more. And so she talks about this dopamine is playing a very big role in motivation, and it's more about wanting than liking. So it's not even necessarily that I like the thing. Often our bad habits are things that we consciously don't like, mm-hmm. and yet something about us wants it. Why does it want that? And she's arguing that both from capital A and lowercase a, addictions are largely driven by this dopamine system. And she talks about, you know, obviously as a psychiatrist, she's looking at very clinical cases of addiction, drugs, alcohol. But she's also talking about these lowercase addictions, and she details her own experience with romance novels and how she was exhibiting addiction-like behavior of trying to hide the readings from her family. She would put it on a Kindle so the people couldn't see what book she was reading.
And losing sleep.
And losing sleep
Yeah.
And so many of us have those sort of secret things where we scroll too much or we're streaming too much or we're doing things that might not be in alignment with our values or our purpose. And part of that has to do with this stimulus wrench. You talked about that environmental component. And so much of our modern day environment is so stimulus rich and dopamine heavy in terms of sort of the provocation. And she talks about this as the plenty paradox. She writes, overabundance is itself a stressor caused by the mismatch between our primitive wiring and our modern dopamine rich ecosystem. And so part of what we have to do is clean up our systems, clean up our environments to help us. And we're going to talk about some of the ways that we can do that. And so, Phil, you want to talk a little bit about sort of our environments and how we might do that, clean those up a little bit?
Yeah, this gets to the definition of what habits are and how they tend to be things that are stimulus driven. And so thinking about your environment very carefully, and this could be your home environment for sure. It can be your work environment. You can think about this in all different types of environments that you operate in, particularly for work environments. If you have a good bit of autonomy in how you do your job, thinking kind of about the routines that you set up. Email is a great example of this, in that I notice that a lot of my friends and colleagues have email notifications pop up on their computer when they're working. And this is that's a very distracting environment. It actually makes it hard to focus. There's kind of a big mental cost in task switching. So you may have a goal to achieve something, but if you're having these kind of constant distractions pop up from email reminders, they're constantly throwing you off your goal. And so doing simple things, this is one of the recommendations Cal Newport made in his work, in his book Deep Work, which I really also recommend, excellent book, is to try and do things like, you know, bin time. You know, if you need to work on email, set several time periods throughout the day where you're actually checking the email and then shut it off, right? So that you have blocks of time to actually do the things that you need to do that move you towards your own goals. And in a work environment, they're not just your goals. They're actually also your organization's goals, right? Now if your environment actually requires you to respond to every email you get within 15 minutes, that's a different environment. And then it's hard to then take control because that is one of your main tasks. I think Essentialism is another book, McGowan. It can make some similar points in terms of the number of things and trying to reduce, really prioritizing your goals. Again, this could be in your personal life, your professional life, and thinking what's most important. And I'm totally guilty of doing too many things, having too many hobbies. Yeah. And the result is that I'm busy and I do a lot of stuff, but I don't necessarily move anything forward. Mm. You know, quickly with a lot of quality. And so trying to kind of peel away, that's why the book is called Essentialism, McGowan's book, right? What are the essential things that you really want to be doing, that you really want to accomplish?
And you know, I think you and I are both struck by that, and Essentialism brings this up as well. Dieter Rams' design philosophy of less but better.
Yeah.
You know, how can we, you know, really invest in the things that matter to us, so that we're proud of the work, we feel that the work is meaningful, and we don't feel that distracted, scattered, inefficient. And it's not all about productivity and efficiency. I think it's also just about that, for me at least, that feeling that the work I'm doing matters.
Yeah, and that you're proud of the quality,
yeah,
too,
right?
So that, what, you know, you and I doing this podcast, obviously this is a topic we care about. We teach classes related to this. And then switching from a weekly format to a biweekly format is part of that less but better, right? Like we felt we wanted more time to kind of craft the narrative of each episode, make sure we were really honing the material that we were bringing in.
Yeah, and I think most people want that feeling of successful accomplishment.
Yeah.
Brad Stolberg, in his book Peak Performance, Elevate Your Game, Avoid Burnout, and Thrive with the New Science of Success, talks about this. And, you know, here we're sort of sounding like a broken record a little bit, but like, how do I do that? How do I bring into alignment all of these things, and how do I make choices about that? And Stolberg writes that, you know, you start with your why, start with your purpose. What is that? If you're clear about the purpose, he writes, purpose fosters motivation. Motivation lets us endure a greater perception of effort, and enduring a greater perception of effort often results in better performance. That holds true in every field and every kind of workplace, right? So once you figure out why you're doing it, then the what becomes much clearer. And then once you figure the why out, then you can start setting some goals. And he also writes, the process of setting a goal on the outer boundaries of what you think is possible. So setting those goals also, and we know this also from some of the positive psychology work, like Martin Seligman talks about, like, you know, or stretch goals, or flow works this way as well. Like, if your goal is ever so slightly outside of your abilities, that forces us to stretch our efforts a little bit, and that causes us to grow, which we find very satisfying as human beings.
We do, and I think one of the key parts you just mentioned there was something that's just a little bit outside of our reach, because one of the things we see in terms of people's, I'll say, goal failure, attainment failure, is that they set unrealistic goals. And some people have a habit of doing this, actually. It's one of the things that sometimes leads into anxiety and depression, is that people set unrealistic goals and then they beat themselves up for not attaining them. And then when they're doing better, then they repeat the pattern. They set, again, unrealistic goals, and then engage in self-deprecating behavior,
right?
Because, right? And so, no, you do want it to be a reach, but not too much of a reach.
And we see that all the time with college students. You know, they'll take way too many credits. They'll take on a sport. They'll take on a club.
Yep.
They'll take on a social life, and they can't understand why they're not sleeping. They're not doing all these other things. And so, yeah, just outside of that stretch goals. And part of that reason that, you know, you brought up sort of New Year's resolutions. And one of the things we also see is one of the reasons those kinds of goals often fail is a lack of specificity. And so people will, you know, on New Year's, they'll say, well, I'm going to get in shape. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to be nicer. And the body, the system doesn't understand what that means. I don't know what get in shape means. I don't know what be nicer means. And so one of the things that George T. Doran, who was a consultant and former director of corporate planning for the Washington Water Power Company, established in the early 80s was this idea of SMART goals. And you've probably heard of SMART goals. There, it's an acronym. In the original version, S was specific, M was measurable, A was assignable, R relevant, and T was time related. And so if you break that down as you set goals, this takes that generality out of the equation. And the first letter is specific. It's hard to do something if it's general, right? And so rather than just like, I'm going to go to the gym, you know, what exactly is it you're doing at the gym? What exactly is that activity, and figuring out exactly the plan?
Because I think it's like, three times a week for 45 minutes each.
Right. And so that gets to that sort of time related point. Like, so now I'm saying, like, I'm going to the gym for those dates at those times, which also allows it to be the M, measurable. Mm-hmm. And so the old equation, like, what gets measured gets managed. Yep. Like, if you don't have a measurement for it, it's like diets. If you don't have a goal, you know why the diet is doing, and then you don't necessarily know if it's working or it's not. Some of that is subjective as well, of course, but like, you have to have a measurement system for yourself. And then the A, because it was a business model, was assignable. We often move that out to say more achievable, which goes to that stretch goal component we were just talking about. Like, if I've never run a race before, it's probably not achievable next month to sign up for a marathon. But it might be achievable to sign up for a 5K, right? And so then I can put that 5K on the calendar, which is going to be a major hack for us. And then it's, again, relevant to our purpose.
Mm-hmm. And so many of these things hit on things we see in the well-being research, mm-hmm. right? That, you know, if I think of Seligman's PERMA model, mm-hmm. Achievement is one of that's the A, and that we like to feel like we are accomplishing things, that we're actually good at something. The relevant part gets at the M in Seligman's PERMA model is meaning mm-hmm. and purpose, right? So these things are, yes, they're moving us towards our goals. They're also things we generally see in terms of well-being.
And then you talked about that sort of self-flagellation and self-deprecation, and like, if you aren't clear about what it is you're trying to do, it's that no wind is favorable. Suddenly, like, I'm a bad student because I can't seem to do any of these things. It's like, well, why are you doing them? You know, what is it? What is achievable for you? And then once you've identified that, then it does sort of self-prophecy becomes achievable.
Yeah, and I guess we've mentioned before this idea of deliberate practice.
Yeah.
So that you're picking something. Okay, I want to be more in shape. Well, what does that mean? What are you actually going to be doing? All right, does that mean I'm pushing my cardio to a new level? Does it mean I'm trying to kind of push my my personal record for lifting or whatever it is, but having some kind of clear definition and goal in mind? So creating habits is kind of what we need to realize, I think, those goals, right? So these SMART goals are very good for tracking them. And we'll see some overlap here in terms of formation, but this idea that we need to understand some of what habits are and how they work to help us move toward goals and essentially live more in alignment with whatever our values and goals are in life.
And, you know, habits have become very popular to sort of explore and talk about in the last particularly 10 years. They've become is a very hot topic, but this is something humans have wrestled with for ages. I think about the famous Greek philosopher, yeah. Aristotle. He thought that habits were the primary factor in shaping a person's character. He says, excellence is a habit. So we are what we repeatedly do. Excellence is not an act, but a habit. Like, we become, through the doing of these things repeatedly, this person.
Yeah, and then similarly, Lao Tzu, possibly a philosopher, possibly a collection of philosophers. We're not actually sure, but there's a collection of works attributed to Lao Tzu, and this quote is credited to that person. Watch your thoughts, they become your words. Watch your words, they become your actions. Watch your actions, they become your habits. Watch your habits, they become your character. Watch your character, it becomes your destiny. And I love that idea. It breaks it down into these simple things. And this is one mm-hmm. of the things we also see with goal attainment in the research, that when you have a kind of a long-term complicated goal, you're more likely to achieve it by really breaking it down into kind of more manageable short-term chunks that are more easily defined. And this is, I think, like, okay, I can focus on my thoughts and words a lot more easily than I can focus on my destiny or my character. Right. I can control my thoughts and words a little better.
Right. And, you know, it's about those little small things. And sometimes it feels like these habits and goals have to be these huge, sweeping, life-changing things. And they don't necessarily have to be. And James Clear's book, Atomic Habits, super popular book about sort of habit formation and building and breaking good and bad habits. And, you know, and also his work reminds me of Dave Brailsford, who was UK's Olympic cycling coach. And this was in the early 2000s. And the British cycling team they were good, but they hadn't really done up, you know, what they thought. They brought on Brailsford, and Brailsford had a philosophy for the team called the aggregation of marginal gains. And what he essentially said was, here you've got these athletes, these Olympic level athletes, but you weren't going to like do a huge overhaul of their diet. You weren't going to do a huge overhaul on their training. But if you just tweaked 1% of their tire, 1% of the chair, 1% of the handlebar, 1% of the helmet, 1% of the suit, 1% of the diet, 1% of their sleep, you just keep tweaking little things, the aggregate of that makes massive changes. Mm-hmm. You know, and so so as people think like, well, you know, my diet's relatively good, is there 1% you could just tweak? Is there little things that you could sort of, you know, tweak those? So it might be that you need a whole habit overhaul, or you need to build one big thing, or destroy or take out one negative thing. That might be possible. It might also be possible you could just tweak it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, in that context, when you're dealing with Olympic athletes, I mean, they're already operating at such peak performance, and they're already focused on their diet and their achievement, that it's all these accumulation of little things that in a way might be all that's left for them. I'll say for us mere mortals,
right.
The same thing holds true, though. When we want to make big changes in life, we're actually going to be more successful by doing them incrementally.
Yep.
Pick a small thing. Think of it as almost like steering a large ship. It's not going to turn on a dime. You're going to change course because, again, the brain is a habit machine. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. And so you just shift a little bit in the direction you want to go. And then as that stabilizes, you shift a little more.
Yep. And another way that Clear talks about in the book is this idea of habit stacking. And so stacking up those things, rather than thinking about them as wholly isolated events, maybe I pair a good habit with another good habit. So I want to read more, and I'm already sort of doing some cardio. Maybe I can read a book or listen to an audiobook on the treadmill or whatever it is. Like stacking those things to maximize the time and that accumulation, that aggregation.
Yeah, and this is the research actually uses this as well. So this is an article published in 2010, How Habits Are Formed, Modeling Habit Formation in the Real World. It was published in European Journal of Social Psychology by Laley and colleagues. And they really wanted to study how long does it take people to form new habits, which is, I think, an interesting question. To do this, they essentially asked people to do exactly what you're saying. They asked them to stack a new habit with something they were already doing, because we want, again, this idea that habits are environmentally cued. So if there's something we're already doing, we want to kind of pair it with that. So they had 96 volunteers. They were asked to start some new behavior on a daily basis. The new behavior could involve drinking something, like drinking a glass of water with breakfast, eating changes, so eating a piece of fruit with lunch, or some activity. Some people pick things like going for a walk before dinner, or going for a jog before breakfast, or meditating. And they asked them to pair it with an activity, not a time of day. The research suggests, again, that that's a little bit more specific and a little bit more stimulus-oriented, where time of day is, it's a little bit more of an abstract principle. So they were instructed to do this and essentially keep a log, a daily log, over a 12-week period. And the daily log included the Self-Reported Habit Index, which I love that we have, you know, acronyms for all these things, the SRHI, to measure the degree to which the behavior was automatic. So essentially they're saying once the new habit is relatively automatic, that's at the point where it's actually a habit. Okay. So they found that habits developed essentially asymptotically, meaning it's not linear. There's kind of a quick uptick in how automatic the behaviors come. And then they start to level out such that more repetition doesn't really make it that much more automatic because you've essentially already achieved relative automaticity. Automaticity is the fancy term we use to say a behavior stimulus driven. It runs without much conscious attention. It's a habit. And what they found in general was about 35 days. It takes about 35 days to start a new habit. And I found this really, like for me, I find this helpful. Like my meditation habit is something that at times I'm really good with and sometimes I'm not. I tend to think about it in terms of a time of day, not pairing it with something in my environment. Okay, so I'm going to change that. And then this 35 days, that gives me personally like a concrete, okay, I just have to do this for over a month to try and ingrain this in a more habitual way than I have been doing it. And similarly, like I tend to default to cardio for exercise, and I'm trying to put in more weight-bearing activities. All right, so I need to, again, set SMART goals, and then over the next month, just stick to that in a way that's measurable. So I find this very helpful and concrete.
And the stacking has been really beneficial to me too, because like meditating in the morning is really beneficial to me to just get my day started. But when I had what we do in Costa Rica is something I've tried to model in the rest of my life. So what I do in Costa Rica when we're there, I get up, I shower, and then I go do a meditation before pretty much anything else is started for the day. And I really like that, even before breakfast, before anything else. But when I'm home, and that goes to your, I think, environmental cues, as soon as I wake up, I want coffee and I need food right out of the gate. And so I often found myself skipping the meditation, even though I cognitively wanted it to happen. So I paired it with my gym time. So I go to the gym after all the other morning stuff. Then I go to CrossFit in the morning, and I was already at the gym. Let me just stay there and do my stretching and my mindfulness, my breath work. And it's been far more successful for me because I think based on this research, it was paired with something I was already doing and it was something I wanted to do. And I could just stack those things together.
Yeah. I find my morning meditation is most successful when I pair it with my coffee. Tea works, you know, tea would be the very traditional Asian version of that, right? But yeah, I'll sit in what essentially on my meditation cushion by my picture window, and I'm not actually drinking the coffee that much, but I'm holding it. It's warming my hands, and that's just kind of become part of the ritual that helps me. So with these, essentially, to get through this 35 days, it requires discipline in the beginning, right? Once the habit is formed, it's relatively automatic. But in the beginning, it's effortful. It requires discipline. So what do we know about discipline?
Yeah, so maybe even starting with like a definition. So discipline is really about sort of staying the course to reach those goals, even when no one is watching. It's more closely associated with the sort of everyday success. If you think grit is more about that sort of long-term commitment to something, discipline is the boring day-to-day grind kind of stuff. And what's important to remember, and it's been really beneficial to me to remember, is that it's a skill as opposed to like motivation or willpower, which are more about feeling. So often I don't feel motivated to go to the gym, but the discipline and the structure, and I think ultimately we're going to keep coming back to this, structures are in place, are doing some of that work for me. And I think it's beneficial if a person out there feels like, I'm just not a disciplined person. What Jocko Willink, his former Navy SEALs, often noted for being a very disciplined person, will say, you're just not a disciplined person yet. And so you can develop that. And so the military, you know, is a great place to look at discipline and how to forge it, because their entire livelihood, or in fact survival, depends on that. And so there was a 1993 U.S. Army monograph by Major Kevin Donahue called Anatomy of Discipline. And what's interesting about this is it kind of also echoes that Lao Tzu quote you talked about. And they break discipline up into two components. Discipline B is the first component, and that's the behavior. And so you're doing things repeatedly in a systematic way to build what he calls behavioral reliability. And once over that time, that behavioral reliability has become, that behavior has become reliable, that shifts into discipline A, which is an attitude. Suddenly that is who you are. And so that Lao Tzu quote you're talking about, those habits over time become your character, become your destiny. That's also sort of what he's talking about here. Those behaviors over time essentially become who you are. And so even minor things, if you know, think about things that one does in boot camp, even like your hospital corner, making your bed every morning. Some of that is about simply becoming the kind of person who makes their bed in the morning. It's like these small behaviors say something about your ability to stick with something, to overcome some adversity, which is what Jocko Willink talks about in his Discipline Equals Freedom. You know, that the discipline is the system. He says motivation is fickle. It comes and goes. It's unreliable. And when you are counting on motivation to get your goals accomplished, you will likely fall short. If you do not believe you are disciplined, it's because you have not decided to become disciplined yet. And so that's I think it's always really important to me to remember that it's a skill that you can develop. And it doesn't – if I am not – naturally a disciplined person. And pre my own time in the Army, I was very disorganized. I was very chaotic in my life, and it led a great deal of stress for me, even if I couldn't quite identify it at the time, and for the people I loved around me as well.
Which is interesting, because I think of you now as a very disciplined person.
I still don't necessarily think that, but I think that I have systems.
Yeah.
I have systems, yeah. And we'll talk about some of that sort of hacks in a minute, but like those systems are for me doing a lot of that work. I've mm-hmm. offloaded my lack of discipline onto systems to do that work.
Yeah, and one of the things I think of as you were talking, how these kind of small changes can have long-term effects in terms of discipline is kind of the classic marshmallow test by Walter Mischel, and this was 1970. And he presented children essentially with, I love it. Here's a marshmallow. It's sitting on the table in front of you. I'm going to step out of the room for 15 minutes. When I come back, if the marshmallow is still there, then you get two marshmallows instead of one. Right. And this is a classic discipline question, or exercise. And some of the kids were able to do that and some weren't. And so those that that were able to withhold, right, to exercise discipline later in life had higher SAT scores, better jobs, essentially all these other life outcomes. And I think that's fascinating, this, you know, kind of simple exercise of discipline and how that reflects essentially your ability to achieve a lot of what we're talking about, these kind of longer-term goals. It's delayed delaying some immediate gratification for the delayed gratification, giving up. And you know, going to college is often this. For many of us, doing many things is, you know, I'm going to give up some simple pleasure now, saving for retirement, for this idea of kind of a future benefit. That requires discipline.
And just to circle it back real quick to the Anna Lemke and the dopamine stuff, like part of her argument is this pain, pleasure, seesaw teetering thing. So as one side becomes too great, the system needs to balance out, because the body is always looking for homeostasis. And so some of the things that practicing a kind of delayed gratification helps to balance out some of that dopamine dysregulation, because the dopamine is saying, do it now, pick up your phone, go on social media right now. And you say, no, I said I'm going to do that at 3 o'clock. It's only 1:55. I'm going to delay that because that's what I said I'm going to do. And in those marshmallows, you can go on YouTube and see all these kids doing it. It's kind of great because they do all kinds of strategies. They'll poke at the marshmallow, or they'll fiddle with their chair, or they'll look at the clock, or they'll do anything else to sort of distract themselves from the thing they kind of want, but want the discipline or practicing the discipline to do it. So discipline isn't always like a magic natural thing.
No, and for me, the mindfulness practice is also really helpful because noticing a craving, that's often the term for it, craving. So yeah, it could be a craving for chocolate, but it could be a craving to pick up my smartphone, or it could be a craving to buy something or whatever. Noticing the craving and labeling it as such makes it easier for me to not act on it. I'm like, oh, I know what's happening, right? You know, my system is pushing me here for some reason, but I can acknowledge the craving, and that somehow makes it easier to set it aside and say, I'm going to acknowledge it but not act on it because it's actually not consistent with my goals at the moment.
And so sometimes, like, the harder we push on that craving rather than just letting it go, the harder we push or grasp it, the more intense it often becomes. We feed it.
We feed it. So why don't we talk about nuts and bolts, right?
Yeah.
So we've gone over a good bit of research and some general things. If I want to be more disciplined, I want to build habits that move me toward my goals more, essentially living more in alignment with my values and goals. What do I need to do? Right. And the first thing I think you and I talked about is rest, which may sound like an odd place to start, but it doesn't when you think about it, because we all, and I'm totally guilty of this, when I'm tired, I am not disciplined at work. I am not focused. I am shopping on eBay. I'm on social media. I'm easily distracted. I'm easily stimulus driven. Those cravings we talked about, the impulse, you know, my impulse control goes. And that's not just me. That's everyone. So being well rested allows this exercise of discipline, allows the focus, it allows you to be more cognizant of whether or not you are doing something in the moment that is or is not consistent with your goals.
And we're going to spend a whole episode on sleep because it's just a fascinating topic to dive into. But that part of that rest and recovery. So, you know, I often think about this from like a weightlifting perspective. So, you know, you just can't constantly stress out the body. You're breaking muscle down in the work, and then you're building it back up in the rest. But even between sets, you know, if you're following a good program, there is recovery built into. You're not just doing a set of 10 and immediately going to another set of 10 and immediately going to another set of 10. You're doing some sort of rest between those or recovery between those. And that is true for any kind of effortful work. So if you're working on a podcast or a book chapter or whatever it is you're doing, taking moments of rest to recoup the system allows you to go back in and attend to that work more effectively.
All right, and then the next one we have here, we already mentioned briefly, was mindfulness. Right? Mindfulness allows you to notice a lot of mindfulness. As we, I think episodes 2 and 3 were all about mindfulness. So if you haven't listened to those, we'd recommend those. People think about it sometimes as checking out. We talked about kind of misconceptions around mindfulness. It's not about checking out. It's about checking in and actually noticing your thought patterns, noticing your cravings, noticing your impulses so that you can be more deliberate with your action. And so a regular mindfulness practice allows you to notice the bad habits, allows you to be more deliberate about creating new habits.
And we already also talked about habit stacking a little bit, but just thinking about like adding another positive habit to an existing positive habit or creating a sequence of those habits. So for me in the morning, part of what I do, I get up, I journal, I do my Spanish lesson, I plan my meals for the day, I write the workout down. I have a sort of a very predictable sequence of activities. And I even like aligned those apps on my phone that my Duolingo is right next to my daily journal is right next to my food log. Like they're all like right in a row.
Nice. And that kind of leads into the next one, this idea of friction, because what I hear you saying is you've reduced friction for some of the things you want to do on a regular basis. And this is my wife likes to say that, you know, with regard to exercise, that getting dressed is half the battle.
Oh, I love that idea.
rather than thinking about the workout and whether or not I have the energy, just put on the clothes.
Yeah.
And so I've taken that, like, if I want to go running in the morning, the best way for me to ensure that I do that is before I go to bed, I take my running outfit. Yeah, well, first I check to see what the temperature is going to be in the morning, put my clothes on the dresser, and when I get up in the morning, that's what I put on. And I've now just lowered the friction in terms of getting out to exercise in the world. And you could also increase friction, right? So I noticed recently I was spending too much time on Facebook and Instagram, and so I've done something I've done before. I just deleted them off my phone. They're still on my iPad. I can still obviously get to them on the computer, but I'm not spending nearly as much time because I've increased the friction. I've made it a little harder for me to do those things because my behavior wasn't lining up with my goals.
And you often hear that with, like, people beginning diets. Like, if you're trying to cut out sweets and cakes and things, the first thing to do is get it out of your house. Make it harder to get. If it's in the house, it's very easy, and so you're more likely to fall back into those patterns. So increasing or decreasing friction to make things easier or harder to do.
That's so true with food for me. I buy healthy food, and that means I eat healthy food.
Right.
If there's bad food in the house, it's bad.
Yep.
All right. The next one I'm going to give you. Yeah. Because you are very much this, give your calendar the power of autonomy or attorney.
Power of attorney. It does. Like, it has the authority. I have signed away my life to my calendar. If it says I do this, then I have to do that. And that's beneficial because it feels like I don't have to do it. The calendar just says, you're going to get up at this time. That's the time the alarm goes off. I go to the gym at this time. And, that also offloads a whole bunch of other stress. So if all the other work I have to do, because I don't keep a to-do list, I put everything on the calendar because every to-do takes time. So if I have to write a letter for a student or I have to prep for the podcast, I have to put that block on. And those blocks can move, but it means that it doesn't go away. So one of the things, like with the gym, I often think of, like, if I have a block of an hour at the gym for the morning and I didn't do it today, it doesn't mean for myself, and this is just how I do it, that I get to delete that block. I have to move that block somewhere else. I don't get to not do that hour of exercise. It has to happen somewhere. So giving your calendar the power of attorney also allows you to offload all of that stress onto another system, so you don't have to waste the cognitive effort of thinking about what's next, what do I have to do, what's at 7 o'clock, what do I need to prepare for. It's all ready there. And that goes back to those SMART goals. Part of the requirement of a SMART goal is that time bound. Like, it has to be able, if I'm doing a 5K race, I need to put on the calendar when it is, where it is, how do I get there, how much time does it take to get there. All those things are part of that. And so if you don't already, to my friends listening, if you don't already keep a calendar, at least start with something.
Yeah, and for me, this is part of why I teach Tai Chi. I want a practice of Tai Chi in my life. I enjoy martial arts. I enjoy the balance, the exercise, the deep breathing, the Qigong, we'll do a future episode on Tai Chi and well-being, but all the well-being components that come with that. And so I am always scheduled to teach Tai Chi multiple times a week because I have to show up and do it, especially as the teacher. I really can't not show up. But this comes to, even if you're not teaching something, you sign up for a class. This is the benefit of signing up for a class. It's on your calendar, right? So another thing is framing things in the positive. Our brain tends to work better with positives than negatives. So rather than I won't do blank, think I will do blank, right? So rather than I won't be late, I'll try and be 5 minutes early, or rather than I won't drink afternoon coffee, I will drink afternoon tea. And this is something we also see that's related to kind of what we call habit substitution. So if there's a habit that you're trying to break, rather than not doing something, think what can you replace it with that's a healthier version. Like, I really do love my morning coffee. Mm. I find that if I drink morning and afternoon coffee, it just doesn't agree with my digestive system as well. If I have a cup of tea in the afternoon, my stomach's much happier. And and I, frankly, and I'm a little less anxious. I'm a little more relaxed. It's better for me to have afternoon tea than coffee. So that simple habit substitution is a way to frame it in the positive.
And we've already talked about this throughout today's episode, but, you know, the right tribe, right environment. If these habits are environmentally cued, that's the people and the places in our lives. And so intentionally surrounding yourself and going to places where the things you're trying to cultivate already are happening is going to help your success more. And so thinking about an accountability buddy, having a mentor, a coach, a person, a friend, someone in your life who's also doing those or exemplifies those habits, and sort of pairing yourself up in that environment is really important. James Clear talks about this in Atomic Habits, and he writes, one of the most effective things you can do to build better habits is to join a culture where your desired behavior is the normal behavior. Right. So I think I have a friend at CrossFit, Luke. He's sort of like I want to be Luke. I want to eat the foods and do the things, because he just seems so effortlessly disciplined and fit, and he's doing all these things that I want to do. And so I'm trying to just sort of watch what he does, talk to him, think about those things and associate myself with those behaviors, because those are things that I want in my own life.
Yeah, and we see this with, you know, meditation communities.
Right.
They talk about having a sangha. You know, again, I have a martial arts class. Well, that's a community of people that we come together and do that. I was talking to someone recently about a yoga class here in town. I enjoy doing yoga, and I know it would benefit my practice to have a weekly class to actually go to. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so find your people, find something that you can do that's going to help with that environment. Okay, so your challenge this week is to pick a goal and turn it into a SMART goal, right? So specific, measurable, achievable, what's the R?
relevant to
relevant
and time bound
and time bound.
Yeah,
of something that's important in your life, and you know, and then maybe you know you can add a habit, take away a habit. But again, think of the things we've talked about here in terms of stimulus based. Try and be as kind of concrete as possible, and then remember that what's required for discipline for a new habit. If you're trying to If part of this goal involves a new habit, remember that month, that first month is going to be particularly effortful. And so make sure you're getting enough sleep, that you're well rested, so that you have, you know, the mental energy to kind of make sure that you're doing this on a regular basis. So that's your weekly challenge.
All right, friends, that is it for this episode. Please subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn as well. If you have questions or comments, or there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to thriveologylab@gmail.com. Thrive on, friends.
Thrive on.